Hello, welcome back. Here we go again then. It's My Mate Bought a Toaster, week 8. It's gone so quickly. I hope you're enjoying this series. I'm really loving making it. And we've got some more fabulous guests coming up. Next week, Catherine Ryan is going to be joining me. Very excited for you to hear that. She is absolutely brilliant. Then we've got Paul Foote on the way. Josh Widdicombe is going to be dropping in as well. And many more guests all still to come. Make sure you check out patreon.com/toasterpod. The Catherine Ryan episode is going to be going up there any day now. patreon.com/toasterpod. You can hear that whole episode with no ads, just beautiful toasty goodness. Apologies for saying beautiful toasty goodness. All right then, so today's episode is brought to you by the lovely human beings over at Hot UK Deals. They are a fantastic website. It's a platform. You go over there and you type in whatever you're after, whatever you want to buy, whether it's socks or an Xbox or some gadgets or a beard trimmer or some sort of hat. And you will find threads of people writing about where the best deals are. There's like 2 million people and everyone's just burrowing away, finding the best deals and then sharing it with each other at Hot UK Deals. It is a fantastic website. We've been running a competition in conjunction with our friends at Hot UK Deals. Well done to last week's winner, who is Julie Norden. Congratulations, Julie. You've won yourself a Hotel Chocolat Velvetizer. It's a brilliant prize. Congratulations. All you got to do is drop me an email, tom@toasterpod.com, and we will sort you right out. What Julie did, the reason she won, is because she followed our YouTube account. If you want to win next week's prize, which, FYI, is a shark vacuum. Oh, yeah. If you want to win yourself a shark, all you got to do is get over to youtube.com. All you got to do is get over to youtube.com/@mymatebought a toaster. That's @mymatebought a toaster, right? Then subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can find, for example, all of last week's episode with Emmanuel Sanubi waiting for you up there. So go to youtube.com/@mymatebought a toaster, subscribe, and then one of you who does that is going to be winning a fabulous shark vacuum. That's all thanks to our friends at Hot UK Deals. Make sure you follow them on all the Instas as well. That is Hot UK Deals. Okay, shall we crack on? Shall we do this? Today's guest is the brilliant Cuive McDonald. You're going to love him. He's a very funny man who looks like Santa. Let the Amazon purchase histories commence.
Oh, when I need a laugh, there's a helping people. But don't pass talking to these funny people. He's asking what they find in the town stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Oh, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster.
Here we go then, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster, and we are today speaking to a fabulous writer. I mean, I first knew him as a brilliant stand-up comedian back in the day. He has now become a crime writer, I assume using all those stage deaths to inspire a brilliant career about crime. But also, there's a sci-fi twist as well. Listen, I'll introduce him. It's the wonderful Cuive McDonald. Cuive, thank you for coming on My Mate Bought a Toaster. How the hell are you?
Delighted to be here. It's an absolute thrill, Tom, because we started off together doing stand-up, so this is like a school reunion for me. It's a delight.
I know. And whenever I do this, I have to resist the urge to just sort of go into these weird gossipy tangents about what happened to... And do you remember him? And she was... Did she... Oh, yeah, no, he died. Like, we just can't do that, okay?
Right, okay, I'll try and restrain myself.
Yeah, yeah. But if at any point you want to, you know, if you want to remember a weird stand-up from back in the day, just raise your hand and I can be... Get Gary Delaney, never, no, I don't know where he went. Michael McIntyre, no, not sure what happened to him. Yep. So, Cuive, so we first knew as stand-ups years and years ago, and now you've got a sort of George R.R. Martin thing going on at the moment as I look at you on this video call.
Yes.
You've got the beautiful white hair still, but also the beautiful white beard as well. So you've, because you're now a writer, you can really let yourself go.
Yeah, yes. And I've leaned into that hard. I mean, you can just see me from the shoulders up now, and thank God, because the rest of the body is not good. No, I've gone full Santa Claus to the point where literally I can't go out in December without kids going, getting all excited and stuff. And I mean, I've had kids scream at me in the middle of summer, "Oh my God, it's Santa." And it's like this woman, this middle-class woman walking her dog going, "I'm so sorry. Oh my God, I'm so sorry." It's like, it's all right. I'm a man with white hair, grew a big white beard. You kind of have to expect that.
I knew what I was doing. But also you can just be like, Santa has to have a holiday vibe. And here he is, you know, Santa's got to go somewhere in summer.
Yeah, exactly. And the great thing with the beard and stuff is you just find it really comforting to stroke. It's like having your own little pet with you at all times.
I've got a theory that men with beards become more and more pompous and sort of theoretical. You know, people who lean back and go, "I've got a bit of a theory." I blame the beard. Because they stroke the beard, there's more thinking goes on.
That could well be it. I mean, it's definitely, it's just, there's something about it that makes it be like, look, I've successfully grown a beard. I probably have opinions people want to know.
If anyone wants to be philosophical and you don't have a beard, put a fake beard on and just see if the act of stroking it sort of pulls at the brain a little bit. It's definitely true. I'm thinking specifically of my friend Guy who does this, similar vibe to you, big white beard. And he often sits back and he starts to stroke his beard and that's when I know to switch off because he's about to begin a long theory about why you see less red cars these days. Do you know what I mean? Or something just like, oh, God.
So, bizarrely, in my head, I am now trying to think of, why do you see less red cars these days?
Stroke the beard.
Welcome to Why You See Less Crowded Cars These Days, the podcast nobody wanted.
All right, but listen, back to the podcast everyone wants. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster. And what we're going to do now, Quave, is dive into your Amazon purchase history, okay? And pleasingly, as I sit here, I've got my iPad open and I can see that your first orders were made in 2001.
Right, that's when I just moved to the UK then. Yeah.
And here we are, and you and I were starting stand-up at the same time. And you'll be pleased by this. This is a neat thing that you've done. The first thing that you've bought, the first purchase you've made on the 22nd of January 2001 is Bill Hicks' Rant in E Minor.
Wow.
I mean, come on. It's so on message. It's an audio CD. You remember CDs?
Gosh, yeah. I still probably have the CD somewhere. Hilariously, by the way, years ago when I started moving, because I have like hundreds of CDs because I used to be obsessive about music. But I did this thing where they were taking up so much room because I buy so many off Amazon and stuff that I took them all and put them into a big case.
Yeah.
And I had all the cases they came in then. So I then went to the dump and just dumped all the cases.
Yeah.
And what was hilarious was I dumped them all in the dump and I could see somebody as I was driving away diving in because I thought I'd actually thrown out CDs. And I saw someone literally try and jump into a dumpster afterwards to get them out.
Not to cast any aspersions on the sort of person who does that. Was it a middle-aged man? Because there's something about us that become collectors. Why is it, and I hope that this isn't a gender-sweeping generalisation, why do men feel the need to hoard and collect and find the comfort in things more? That feels general, but I just know a lot of men who do that.
Yeah, and I do that. I mean, I sort of used to that. I used to do that with music. I'm now doing that with other stuff.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. And it's true. Every time you go to a convention or anything, like a sci-fi or fantasy convention, there's the people collecting stuff. It is men. It's a weird sort of instinct. I don't know. I think it's because women prefer talking to people where men like find comfort in objects or something.
Yes, and that's why men often treat women as objects as well. Oh my God, the beard truths.
Beard truths. Now that is a podcast.
I mean, I'm available. Why not? I've got a golf podcast. I've got this one. Quave, we're going to do beard truths. It's going to happen. It's fun looking at this Bill Hicks set list. And at this point, by the way, you've moved to the UK from Ireland and you've started stand-up, right?
Yeah, I came over. I was working in the city of London. Bizarrely, doing IT support, and I'd moved it. Yeah, I wasn't living with Gary at that point. No, that comes later. Mm. Actually, I moved it with my sister, bizarrely, for a year. You know the guy who runs Glastonbury? They're that family that does Glastonbury.
Michael Eavis.
She bought a flat that Michael Eavis bought for his kids when they were in London in university. So we were in there, and they basically, my sister and brother-in-law did the whole thing up. So I was living there in a ridiculously nice flat for a ridiculously low amount of money because I was her brother. So that's where it would have been in 2001 because that's where I was trying to get a job. Mm. Where this is really odd, but every time someone asks me when I start stand-up, I always remember because I did stand-up over here. I was here for 6 months on a placement.
Yep.
But thought, right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do stand-up and writing. And I came over and did courses and stuff. And then I remember just starting up stand-up and then we all stopped for a month because September the 11th happened.
That's when I started. That was my first gig in London was the 15th of September 2001.
Wow, really? Because I remember they cancelled that week and stuff.
Yeah.
We kind of forget how seismic an event that was, but I can remember people going, well, you can't laugh about anything for like the next couple of weeks.
Yes.
So you did your first one that week?
Yes, the Amuse Moose for Hills J Goat, my first one, and there was very few people there, and it was really weird, and it was the first few gigs, and you think, oh, this is what gigging is like, sort of somber, like you're right, you do forget the seismic event, and the fact that, you know, before social media and stuff, before us being told to feel whatever it was, the anger or whatever, people, here's a theory, beard stroking, I feel like people reacted in a more natural, spontaneous way. I feel like social media and constant information on our phones guides our emotions too much and forces us to feel certain things. And I think at that stage, everyone felt a genuine sense of shock. Like it was just pure silent shock, wasn't it?
I mean, it was like there is a performative element to anything. You think, oh my God, I need to express my opinion of this. And therefore you're not really... Because I was, in all seriousness, I was in the City of London and our company was doing a thing where we were in BP, the oil company. And the weird thing is, you know, at the time they said, we're not sure who this attack was from. They evacuated the oil companies 20 minutes after it happened.
Jeez.
They knew who it was.
Well, I'm glad we started the podcast.
I was going to say, this has got weirdly...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Really good. Really, really good. Ooh, my big boy, a toaster. My big boy, a toaster. Shoving our lines at a pencil by my big boy, a toaster. Here you are listening to Bill Hicks, starting to do the gigs. What was the first sort of... conclusion you came to? What was the first lesson you learned from doing stand-up in the UK? What was the first thing that... And by the way, we see lots of stand-up stuff here. You're buying Comic Lives, Inside the World of American Stand-Up Comedy. Stand-Up by Oliver Double. Lots of people bought that book.
Yeah,
lots of stuff about stand-up specifically. What were you learning and how fast were you learning it at this point?
I think, weirdly, one of the biggest things that happened, actually, bizarrely, was I think it was my sixth ever gig. And I was... The first one went well. And then in hindsight, I think the first one went well because there were a bunch of Americans in. And they just found somebody talking fast in an Irish accent hilarious. Because I was like, I'm incredibly fast. I've always been ridiculously fast as a talker. It's amazing, frankly, with someone which is as poor a delivery as I have, managed to make a living as long as I did in stand-up, because I am not natural for that regard.
You never needed to write new material. You just made a noise for years. It was great stuff.
Yeah, just literally, I've so many times on stage, I said something and the audience didn't say anything, and I went, did I go too Irish too fast there? They're like, yeah, I didn't understand it. None of us got that. So I think my sixth ever gig was in the Laughing Horse in Richmond. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Gigs 2 through 5 had not gone well. Yeah. And 5 was particularly bad. And I can remember bizarrely, like in a film, I've never noticed before or since, and it's such a horrible cliche thing. I was in Maidenhead where I was doing this placement thing. I looked in the mirror on the wardrobe and I talked to myself and went, right, you can stop doing this after this, but you have to go and do this gig because they're relying on you. Hilariously, they weren't relying on me, as you know. If I didn't turn up, 4 of the people were waiting to go on. But I was like, so you have to do this, do it one more time. And I went to that gig, which was always a competition, bizarrely. And I came second to a guy with stolen jokes. And I bonded with a bloke standing at the back who'd also been on, we went through and identified what all the jokes were. And that was Gary Delaney, who ended up being my flatmate for a decade. And I was supporting him on tour and everything.
Yes.
My last ever stand-up gig was supporting Gary on tour. And I don't think I'd have a career except for Gary and stand-up, because every time I looked like I was fading out, he was like, nope, just staying in.
This is what I love about stand-up, all those little moments, but also anything you do, those formative little standing at the back of the room bits, you know, and just seeing, you know, you have no idea the sliding doors moments just happened. You've just jumped on the train. You have no idea that's just happened. That's just beautiful. Beautiful.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. But that's the first time anyone's referred to Gary Delaney as beautiful. All right.
I mean,
he's a gorgeous man.
Yeah, no,
inside.
I can't really.
He's lovely.
He's handsome more than beautiful. That's
very,
what I'd say.
Very funny boy. All right, let's crash on through 2002 now. Only a few purchases here. William Goldman, 4 screenplays. The collected screenplays of Joel and Ethan Coen there. Richard Pryor, It's Deep Two. So again, this is what we'd expect to see. Oh, look, Red Dwarf. Oh, come on. You've got the Red Dwarf radio show. I didn't know that existed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because I literally went through years of just reading scripts, because at that point I was pitching sitcom ideas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I weirdly ended up writing kids TV.
Did you? Which one? Which
Oh, bits? I did. There's a thing called Bear Behaving Badly that it's one of these things that it was the biggest thing on BBC for a few years, but I was the lead writer, and that was, which is a little blue bear, Nev.
Yeah.
He basically made me go full time as a writer and write stand up and frankly bought my apartment. I also created a thing called Pet Squad, which was nominated for a BAFTA, which was a cartoon series.
Right.
Because I sort of never was just a stand up. I mean, I think I've I've had something like 10 sitcoms optioned over the years.
Yeah.
And they never went anywhere and stuff, because that's the joy of being a writer. Difficult thing. But the great thing with kids' TV is you can write, like, kids' TV is you actually get in and write stuff rather than just trying to pitch sitcoms all the time. Most of the best writers in British TV, I would say, they don't put it on their CV, but loads of them did kids' TV, like Armstrong.
Yeah, why is that? I mean, that's a good question, isn't it? There's a sort of slight shame about it. There's a slight embarrassment that they did kids' TV. And it's, you know, similarly as an actor as well, I was often told by my agent, don't go up for kids' TV stuff. And I wish I had, like that Horrible Histories audition. That would have been good to get. It is true, though, that kids' TV is sort of frowned upon. Why is that? Strange.
Well, it's because it is. I mean, look, I'll be honest. Now I haven't done it for years, but it's kind of... It can be done. It's done on shoestring budgets, and they're getting smaller and smaller. So they're literally like, they recorded fast. So I must admit, I didn't watch all the stuff I'd written, because after you've seen a couple of jokes get hammered badly, you're like,
ugh. We do that again. Who was that? It's the writer. Get him off set. This speaks to what we do when we go out and do stand up on the circuit or whatever creative endeavor people might do when they're writing and stuff. You know, right? You have to stay really tuned and in touch with that voice that knows if something works. And when you do stand-up, you get used to that audience being in front of you. You get used to a sense of what will work. And it becomes like an extra muscle in your brain that goes, yeah, that's going to be funny. Which is why when you look at the big showrunners, I mean, I'm obsessed with Russell T. Davis, for example.
Oh, yeah,
that's
amazing.
Not necessarily comedy. But it's the narrative vision and passion and drive that is correct and is trusted. And to get to that position, you have to batter through the sort of all those leagues of people, the committees.
I remember my experience of that was, like, I remember, because obviously I've known Sarah Millican since she was very early in her career and stuff. She's a very close friend of mine. Obviously, she's married to Gary and all that.
Yeah.
But I remember being in when we were doing the pilot for her TV show.
Yes.
And at that point, they were sort of weirdly, the BBC wanted, they were worried about other things being similar. So they had all this stuff about it can't just be this, it has to be that. And we had to go through all these sort of weird kind of tortured logic for the pilot. But we did the pilot, and the pilot just worked because she was so good in it.
Yeah.
They discovered basically that as well as being good at stand-up, she was fantastic at talking to people.
Yeah.
And I could remember standing at the back watching a monitor, myself and Gary, and just looking at each other and went, this is working, we're off. This is just like you can just see this audience's reaction.
I remember
being in the things with her.
Yeah.
And she was, because she knows who she is. The reason why Sarah went so quickly, so fast is Sarah found her voice.
She had that.
And she's always understood who she is.
Yes.
And like, first thing she did was they said, we'll get some writers. And went, all right, but half of them are coming from people I know from the circuit. And she then picked like me and Juliet Myers, a few other people like that.
Oh yeah, Juliet Myers, yes.
Weirdly, we actually had a meeting. That's right. We had a meeting with the writers, with the producer before Sarah was there.
Right.
And this producer was pitching these things. And exactly that. None of us had the courage to go, oh, that's not going to work for Sarah.
Yeah.
And she just came in though and went, Brealey, no, yes, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she was right. And it wasn't like she was being a demon. It's because she understood who she is.
Yeah. It's that thing though. You want to inject that wisdom into the 21-year-old version of yourself and go, just so you know, you're going to learn really quickly what works and what doesn't work. Just crack on. Yeah. Just crack on.
We like to listen to Toast. And we're not the kind who would boast. And even in spite of the host, we still like to listen to Toast. La, 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 la.
Let's move forward in time now. Let's go to 2003. We've got the 70 greatest conspiracies of all time. History's biggest mysteries, cover-ups and cabals.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is because we're like, one of the books I write now is A Stranger Times, which is set in the newspaper in Manchester that basically the 14 times, I don't even know, is that. It's that they report weird and wonderful stuff from around the world, conspiracies and all that. And I've always been fascinated by those things. Because that's the thing. People always go, oh, you're conspiracy. And I said, no, I find them fascinating. I don't believe almost any of them, but I think they're incredible.
Yes.
I mean, to be honest, they've kind of now been spoiled by weirdly becoming mainstream and actually affecting our lives, which I didn't ever want.
And it's sort of dangerous.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Like, I was working in Y2K. Do you remember that? That'll date me.
The Millennium Bug.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you know, actually, I've never said this before, but this is true. When I was working in the City of London, I was in charge of the disaster recovery site for BP at one point. Which is basically, if the building blows up, we go to this other building and then all our systems immediately change over. Because if BP literally stops trading for a minute, they lose £3 million or some. They figure this number out, right?
Yeah.
I was in charge of that. I didn't know what I was doing. I distinctly remember sitting in this big, massive, millions and millions of pounds of stuff around me. And I was sitting there eating a sandwich in this room going, if this doesn't work, I mean, I'm getting fired, but Like, I remember genuinely thinking, can I go to prison if this doesn't work? Like, I don't, is there a, like, just being incompetent doesn't get you arrested. Like, this was the thing I was having. Is like,
I love,
man,
that.
I need stand up to go well because I need to get out of here before somebody tries, before that building falls over for any reason.
I love that BP had no idea that the disaster was already in the building eating a sandwich. Just, yes. Oh.
I'm the problem, it's me. I was Taylor Swift before Taylor Swift. Yeah, I was like... the greatest risk to BP was actually the disaster recovery site taking down their main computers by mistake.
Amazing. There's so many IT people right now listening and watching going, oh, God, he's busted us. Don't out us, please.
What's the purchase history of this jokester? Stay tuned for my mate bought a toaster.
Welcome back to part two of My Mate Bought a Toaster. Just got time to tell you about False Economy. It's a great podcast hosted by Vic Slayton and Paul Watson. Go and have a listen after you finish today's episode, and you can enjoy things like the topic of Mongolian yurts in Notting Hill. It's a podcast all about retail quirks, from great bargains to horrific rip-offs and everything in between. It's really, really good. Make sure you check it out. It's called False Economy. Search for it on all your favourite podcast platforms. That's False Economy with Vic Slayton and Paul Watson. All right then, shall we re-dive back into the fabulous Queeve McDonald's Amazon purchase history? I think we shall. Conspiracy theories are fascinating. I agree with you. You don't have to believe in them at all, but just to also, they're sort of, I sort of admire the writing, and I admire the moment that every now and again, you get a little sparkle from a conspiracy theory about the pyramids being in exactly the right geolocation for aliens, and you just go, oh, that's delicious.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and what we realise when you've watched them as closely as I do, all the sort of QAnon stuff and all that, when people say, where did this come from? Basically, you take on anything that happens, you can reverse engineer it to explain that what you were saying makes that makes sense with it. So you basically throw out all of these things, like the David Icke thing, classic. People always say, David Icke predicted this back in 2001.
Yes.
He also predicted nuclear war the next year. And, you know, all you do is you throw out a load of crap.
Yeah.
Some of it hits. And then what's amazing is what the exact opposite of what they say is going to happen happens. They can just change the narrative. And people bizarrely don't notice that everything they said was wrong.
No.
Like, this, the amount of cults in the world that have predicted the world ending multiple times and it hasn't happened... And incredibly, they don't lose members. That's the part I can remember doing, because I ended up doing a Edinburgh show, a terrible one, kind of about this, about predictions for the future.
Yeah.
But that was the thing that always confused me, is like, literally, and I love, I mean, religious cults and all. There was one where, because one of these things about in the Bible, people will ascend to heaven when the apocalypse comes, and those closest to God, and one religious sect, I think it was a variation of possibly Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that, some weird little subsect. They believed that it was physically, you had to actually physically be closer. So they spend an awful lot of time at a certain point jumping out of trees, trying to be physically closer to heaven, because up in the sky, and loads of them like constantly breaking their legs jumping out of trees. Which is just amazing. I mean, like, those kind of things are just delightful to know.
Ironically for them, Darwinism, you know, at its best, isn't it? It is just... incredible. But it must be, can you imagine the awkwardness of, you know, I'd love to be there in the half hour after the world hasn't ended. Okay. All right. Okay. Has anyone got any food in? No, we didn't get anything in for Tuesday.
No. Well, we have a drink, but I wouldn't take it. it's a little tart. Yeah. But I always thought that was a fantastic idea for a book or a sitcom or something, like
yes.
a group of people who are in a cult and then they have to sort of keep living together because the world didn't end.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how people will go from that to the next one and stuff. And it's obviously just...
Yeah.
It's extraordinary the human mind can adapt what it thought it knew and be so certain about the next thing.
Yes.
I'm amazed. Like, I'm never that certain about anything. And these people are so certain all the time about everything.
Oh, I long for certainty. What an absolute luxury that must be to know things for sure. I'm jealous of people who've got things like, you know, faith and principles. I could never have those, Queeve. It's just not possible.
No.
I'm just going to prevaricate. I'm very comfortable on the fence. Thanks very much. let's dive on ahead a bit now, right? Because what I tend to do on this pod all the time, and there's been complaints, I really spend way too long early doors on like 2003, 2004. And then I forget. We've only got like an hour or whatever. And then at the end, I'm like, oh, okay, so 2021, oh, God, you bought 8,000 things, and they're all really interesting. So I'm going to jump, okay? We're going to go on a little time leap into 07. So by this point, successfully writing on TV, we're doing stand-up, still living with Gary Delaney at this point. Is that...
Possibly in Birmingham, yeah. I think
I'm getting Leamington Spa here.
Myself, Gary, and my now wife moved in together, and Sarah Millican was not living with us, but she was there like a couple of nights a week, because Leamington Spa is very handy for everywhere in the country.
Yes, it makes sense as a stand-up or any kind of sales situation you may have. Head for the spa.
Yeah, absolutely.
So March 2007, you've got The Lucifer Effect. So many interesting books that you've got here. The award-winning, internationally respected psychologist Philip Zimbardo examines how the human mind has the capacity to be infinitely caring or selfish, kind or cruel, creative or destructive.
I mean, I've not read it, I'll be honest. I had a weird moment earlier this year. We moved house. Mm. And you know that thing when you move house, you start finding all the stuff you've just put in a cupboard and ignored. Mm. And I found Amazon boxes I'd never even opened, if I'm honest. God. And I was actually having this moment myself where I was kind of berating myself, going, yeah, you always have these ideas. You're going to do this, you're going to do that. And like, that would have been for something like some Edinburgh show idea or something I had that lasted 2 days. Yeah. The amount of times I've had an idea, and by the time the thing turns up, I've forgotten or the idea is gone.
Yeah.
And I literally had this moment where I went, oh, you're always buying these things and having stupid ideas. And then I literally had this moment where I went, one of your stupid ideas was, I'm going to write a novel. And that worked out really well. So I literally gave myself a break. But almost the first time in my life, I went, some of your stupid ideas work.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Your stupid idea of standing in front of that mirror at that gig and keeping on going, that's worked out all right. You know, it's so true. We are pebble dashing our lives. And every now and again, there's a pebble that sticks, and that's the one.
That needs to be a poster. We are pebble dashing our lives.
We are pebble dashing our lives, guys. The Lucifer Effect as well. How good people turn evil. I would say a great book just to have, like, if you're bringing your first date home back to the boudoir and you've got it on your bedside table.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? What's that? Nothing. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Just The Lucifer Effect. It's all about how good people turn evil. I mean, there's some great reviews of it. This book takes us where angels fear to tread, uncovering the Lucifer that sits incubating in each individual and every human institution. I mean, Queef, I would say, even though you haven't read this book, this does feed nicely into where you've gone with your writing, because obviously you write crime stuff, and that's something you have to tap. Maybe you should read. What I'm saying is maybe you should read this book that you bought.
Yeah, well, maybe. Because to be fair, my books are, I do obviously write the crime books and then the paranormal stuff and all, but because they're all generally funny, but people, I've read a lot of books where people are trying to do funny crime or funny something else.
Yeah.
And where they actually go wrong is they try and be funny. Like, they're actually trying to be funny, and the reason they're like doing something is to get to a joke idea. Mm. And weirdly, what I do is, like, I have a clip, where I'm sitting right now in my office, I have a big board beside me where they pin up all the cards with all the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
There's never a joke on there. All I'm doing is planning out where the book's going.
Yes.
And like, people sort of say, how, like, it's really annoying when I get asked to do writer's podcasts, because I get asked, so how do you write funny? Do you want the honest answer? You'll understand this, Tom, and other people find it really annoying. I just do. Oh. Like, if I'm honest, the difficulty I have is to not make something funny, like not taking the piss out of something, frankly. Yeah. It's literally in my brain. I think like a stand-up comedian, even though I haven't been one for a few years now.
Yeah.
You just have that in your head. And it's, you're programmed that way. And it's a problem in real life, to be honest. Because I've been in the supermarket with Gary Delaney, where he makes a phenomenally inappropriate joke that occurred to him to a woman behind the counter who was not impressed. And I was like walking out going, that was socially embarrassing. He's a good gag, though. I said, yes, it was a good gag. But you're not supposed to actually say them to people in real life.
I would say that most people who've been on the stand-up circuit, I'm sort of monetizing the damage that 10 years on the circuit did to me by working in radio.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I've now got a brain that will just go, find the funny. But I getting back to the book thing, I find that really interesting. The structure is everything. And I get really frustrated because I read a lot of I love crime stuff, and I avoid comedy. When I see writers are writing overtly comedy stuff, I'm like, I'd rather just have a really good story. And that's really huge for you, because that's why people love your stuff, because it's all about clarity and a good story, and then the stuff that dangles off.
The thing I always say about my books, and it's kind of, we get a lot of feedback, like 10 or 12 emails a day. Oh, I want to find out what happens next. And I think the big thing is you want to find out what happens next to those characters.
Yeah.
You make people care about the characters, and how you make people care about the characters is you care about the characters.
Yes.
And
yes.
Like, I find myself naturally caring about my characters.
Do you cast them in your head? Do you know which actor's playing them? How do they look? Do you see them?
Yeah, weirdly, I mean, Bunny McGarry is the one who's the main character in my crime books. Mm. And he was never supposed to be this. Literally, I based him on somebody I knew. Okay. Right. And he was a small little chubby fella from Cork in Ireland who was literally, actually, I can say this now, it doesn't matter. London Irish Rugby Club. I used to be the announcer in the stadium.
You were?
Yeah, yeah. I was the voice of London Irish for 13 years. I was the announcer in the stadium in Reading. And Macker, there was a guy who was the sort of manager, but he was a guy from Cork. And it was hilarious because you'd have like Samoans and Kiwis and all these different guys because they're a rugby team, right?
Yeah.
And they'd be sitting on the bench and Macker be sitting at the end of the bench and he just sort of, when something went down the field he'd like, he'd just be, what the fuck is it's like hearing a fax machine have a breakdown. It was incredible, right? And like literally you'd see guys who were like 300 pounds who were Samoan rugby internationals looking at this man absolutely terrified because this small little fella was just having, they could not understand what was happening.
Oh, it's the little ones you've got to watch. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but he would lose his mind and then I sort of took him, this Cork accent and him and sort of made him the character. A month before the book came out, because we did it ourselves because nobody was interested. We literally got told it was too funny and too Irish. So we did it ourselves. And a month before it came out, I remember going to my wife going, people are going to realise this is based on Macker. So instead of making him a short, chubby guy, I made him a big fella. And I changed the name McCarthy to McGarry. And now everyone goes, well, this is based on Brendan Gleeson. And I'm like, no, it's pure, entirely coincidence.
Yeah. But if Brendan's available to play the character in the inevitable TV adaptation...
Yeah, I mean, they're currently trying to make it, like, they're talking about TV adaptation stuff, but yeah, so I don't know if they put it, but it's, yeah, it is the weird thing where everybody says that to me, and I go, honestly, I was just trying to not get punched by a little fella from Cork if you realise I take, put him in a book.
That's great. Vitamins B and C and D, get it for myself, for my health, on the cheap, gotta stay in shape, but I'm so lazy, cram online, next day delivery. 17th of January 2012, Dad's Army, the home front, the complete scripts of series 5 to 9, studying the scripts, there you are, you see.
Oh, obsessively. I literally, for like a decade, just read script. I didn't reread much prose books. I was literally almost always reading scripts.
Look, 2012 as well. Are we about to start writing, by the way? At what point does Quive become the writer?
A novelist, not until like 2015, 16, I think it
but
was.
Look,
yeah,
look,
2016
here we go.
My first book came out.
This is interesting. 24th of January, 5-star record cards. So those little white plastic cards to write notes on, and 5-star push pins. So you've bought push pins, and you were describing earlier on how as you write, you've got your cards with your novel bits on. So are we seeing some evidence of it here?
Yeah, I must have been doing that for some TV stuff, what have you, where I got a push board and all that. Because I've always never been able to write in my house. Because basically, I just find it hard to focus. And literally, I'll be sitting in my spare room.
Yeah.
I'll be writing away. I'm writing a script. You know like those things where people get taken up by aliens and they lose time? Like, I'm writing a script. It's like, the next thing you know, I'm standing in the fridge having a... I was like, how am I in the fridge? What's happened here? So I always end up going outside of the house. Like, bizarrely now, where I'm sitting right now, because I am at my home, but basically we have this big office at the back of the garden, because if I'm physically outside the house, it's fine.
Yes.
Which was a weird thing in lockdown, because we bought a house in 2019, it was our first house.
Okay.
And we tried to get an office outside, and if someone had an office in their back garden in 2019...
Mm.
Estate agents said, don't mention it. People hate those things.
Oh.
So we had to like look through pictures of houses and you'd see a structure outside the window.
I mean.
And you'd ring up and go, is that an office by any chance? Said, yeah, but don't worry about it. I said, no, we want one.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And then 2020 happened. And we ended up buying a house and putting an office in. 2020 happened and everybody in the country was trying to get an office in their back garden.
Oh my God, I can just, the smug that must have been coming off you, radiating it. That is,
yes.
Yeah, it's true though. I mean, it's that thing of people who accidentally did things, they didn't realise they were preparing for the lockdown. Do you know what I mean? And then it came along and they were good to go. It is just,
My wife signed up bizarrely on Amazon. I think it's probably in her account, not mine, but she signed up just to bulk order before 2020. She signed up to just get toilet rolls and bulk. She thought, we'll just get them come every, you can get, it's a cheaper thing to subscribe. And then the lockdown, because you know there was all this, the toilet rolls were that
ridiculous thing. The bog roll ones.
But we already had that subscription. And at one point, like the subscription turned up with all these toilet rolls. And they just, like, they don't put them in a box. They just give you all these toilet rolls. Elaine was going, oh, the neighbours have just seen this. Oh, they think we're monsters because I forgot we had that subscription.
We've been doing this for years. Hi, guys.
Yeah.
I've been banging my pots on a Thursday night for years. No one liked it then.
Yeah.
Only now.
My husband has always been a big pooer. always needed a lot of toilet roll. The man goes through a lot of food.
Oh, God,
okay?
The shame.
I don't need to explain the biology to you. It's not our fault.
That's why you're constantly moving on. It's time to go. The looks we're getting from the neighbours. 1st of March 2012, soft silicon earplugs, value pack of six there. There you are.
Oh, they're a big... I wear an eye mask and earplugs every night when I sleep. I'm such a nightmare to get to sleep otherwise.
Of course, because you've got the queev brain. You've got the stand-up creative brain whirring away. The only thing you could do is either drink until you die or do this, which seems better.
Yeah, it just feels like I'm just basically, my job is to take down what it says.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I'm literally
the
stenographer for my brain. I'm not really in charge of it. It just works on its own. And off I go. You know,
out of context, it makes you sound absolutely crazy. But in the context of being creative, it's amazing what you can get away with because you're a writer. He sits in his shed all day long with bog roll. It's fine, he's a writer.
Okay, whoa. The bog roll is not in the office with me. Let's not just join those two things together.
Liar.
Oh, I've bought so many embarrassing things. Pink CDs and a toddler dancing.
Look, we're going to go to 2018 now, okay? Again, still loads and loads of books that you're buying here. Let's go to, again, also, you bought a lot of things. In 2018, you bought 212 things.
Yeah, I'd imagine I might have the record for the most things of anyone you've had on this podcast.
Well, Alex Zane holds it at approximately 300, and I think it's about 365, something like that. It was just about an item a day. 2019, 247. 2020, that's usually when we peak. He's done it. We found ourselves a new toaster champion. Congratulations to Queeve McDonald, who in 2020 placed 401 orders.
Why do I feel pride?
Oh, you should. I've interviewed 120 people on this podcast, Queeve. No one's come close. Alex Zane was very close. And then behind that, it's like 200 tops. That's really, really good.
In my defence, we have a dog. Actually, we've two now. We had one at that point, and we spoiled the dog a lot.
Is that why you bought him Peter May's A Silent Death and Lisa Jewell's The Family Upstairs? No, this isn't for a dog. Yeah. You don't read murder books to your dogs.
No, true. To be fair, a lot of those are actually Kindle purchases. So my carbon footprint isn't as big as that makes it look.
Just take it.
Let's just pretend it was me reading a lot.
I like this. The Jigsaw Puzzle Roll Mat, October 2020. Are you a Jigsaw Puzzle fan?
Oh, well, we weren't until 2020. And then myself and the wife started doing jigsaw puzzles. And I remember they were actually, do you know what they were? The jigsaw puzzles great for is you can't think about anything else when you're doing the jigsaw puzzle. Yes. It takes your mind up. It's kind of like now, I've got a hobby. You'll see this coming up in the next couple of years. There'll be loads of stuff where I've taken up, basically I play a tabletop board game called Blood Bowl, which is like a sort of fantasy version of rugby NFL thing with like orcs and elves and all this dwarves, all this kind of stuff.
Wow. That's the mashup we all needed.
Yeah, because basically though, my wife sort of, because that's the weird thing when I gave up stand-up, at one point Elaine went, you need to find a reason to get out of this house that doesn't involve the dog. Because basically, as you know from stand-up, your social life when you're stand-up, it just comes with the job. You go, you do gigs on Fridays and Saturdays, you hang out with people there and stuff like that. You don't have a normal life. Like, the reason myself and the wife were such a perfect match is she was always very independent. She had her own social life. And then when I stopped gigging, she'd stuff like, well, I'm going out. I was like, oh, where are you going? So, can I come? I was like, oh, I guess you can. Yeah.
Been here before. It's Santa. He comes with me. He just follows me everywhere.
Yeah, because she'd go to weddings at her own because I was never around because I was gigging.
Yes, you've got no excuse now. You've got to go and see people, Queeve. I'm so sorry.
I literally can't avoid people and stuff. But basically, I needed to find a reason to get out of the house. And she was like, and like, women are great at just chatting to people and like having friends, but men don't really talk to each other as much without a reason. Like, Gary Delaney's my oldest mate, and we don't talk as much. Like, we go to the cinema together and we turn up, we get there just for the trailers. We sit there while the trailers are on, how are things? Yeah, fine. Yeah, yeah. And literally, at one point, we went, we should maybe meet beforehand and you know, eat something or something and have a conversation that's not where we're sitting facing a screen.
Yeah.
So I needed a thing to do. And I always quite liked the idea of this game, so I started playing this game, and it's a lot of fun. And you can see behind me, all that stuff is all paints and stuff, because I am terrible at painting. But I've discovered that I enjoy just turning my brain off. It's like the jigsaw puzzles, but there's your point. It's a great way of just turning your brain off and giving yourself a bit of space.
and you don't realize what you're doing. And in fact, okay, here's the thing, to flip it on its head, you're not turning your brain off. What you're doing is actually recharging it. You're plugging it in.
Oh, yeah.
When you do those things, so mine is Sudoku, right?
Yeah,
yeah. But when I'm doing Sudoku, it's an ADHD that I've got ADHD, and I hyper-focus on it when I'm doing Sudoku. And it is plugging my brain in because I'm not thinking, and that means that the energy is rebuilding up again so I can start to have the thoughts all over again. It is that. You have to have something like that.
And a lot of the time with my stuff, I think today I was even just doing some stuff before we started recording, and I was like working on a new project, and then like literally my subconscious sort of went, oh, you could do that, by the way. I was like, oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And like literally I was in the middle of just like painting something and went, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then just kept going. I was like, again, it's not like I'm doing it. It's my brain just did it in the background while I was giving it the time to relax and do that, I think.
It's good. I like this. There's a theme to today's episode. Just trust yourself. Trust your brain. It's good. It's good. It's good. Loads and loads of things in 2020. We've got wet food for the dog. Are you got one dog or two dogs now then?
We've got two dogs now. We've got one who's basically, God love him, allergic to everything and is very anxious. He's also got more love in him than any creature you'll ever meet in your life. Literally, I was just downstairs, because I'm recording this in my office. We had a chimney sweep in, cleaning the chimney. Yeah. And I was, I must admit, I felt quite guiltily like, oh, I've got that podcast, so I don't have to be down here trying to deal with the chimney sweep and the two dogs. And like, Diller, the really anxious dog, is white. And I just, before we record, I ran downstairs just to use the loo and stuff. And the dog ran out, and the dog is covered in soot. Because he's been up licking the face of the guy cleaning the chimney. And then my wife just went, he got on fire with the guy, so we just let him go up. But yeah, he's covered in soot. We have to wash him.
I love it. Well, you can't put children up there anymore because of political correctness, so you might as well stick dogs up the chimney.
Oh, we'd love it. We do this thing called barketing with our books, where we, the best thing you can ever have is a picture of your book with a dog. People will share that way more than me talking about my book or something like that. Yeah. But with the two dogs, there's Diller who, like, you put the book in front of him and you, like, you see him, like, he's like, am I doing this right? Am I doing this right? Because whereas the other one, every time you put the book beside him, he just sort of moves a bit away from it. He's like, yeah, I'm not really a fan of his work.
It's all made up. It's not even real. There's none of it.
Diller was abandoned, because they're both rescues. Diller was abandoned twice, but the first time was in Liverpool. Okay. But the other guy was abandoned. He was literally found halfway up a mountain in Cyprus, starving to death.
Oh.
And you'd think he would be grateful. He is the most entitled little shit in the world.
That's why he was abandoned in the first place. Just so arrogant. He's cross. Yeah. He wants to go back. It was his mountain. That's what you don't realise.
He's spectacularly arrogant. God. He's the level of arrogance that you have to actually admire. That it's, you know, that way sort of.
Yeah, I love that.
I think
love
he's the most mentally healthy creature I've ever met in my life. He doesn't care what anybody thinks.
All right, elsewhere, 1st of December 2020, Under No Illusion by Paul Daniels.
Yeah, I think that was, I've actually bought that because Danny Buckley recommended it to me, a good friend of ours, a comedian and brilliant magician, because I was writing a short story about magicians and I was asking for research things.
Yeah, okay. It's all research, that's what you've always got. Also, you've obviously been researching C.K. McDonnell, whoever he is. You've bought The Stranger Times, 12th of January 2021. You've bought one or two copies. You sent one to Matt Green, who's previously been on the show. The comedian Al Barry got a copy as well. We'll be asking all them if they've read it, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've basically, we do a Stranger Times podcast where I wrote some short stories and they narrate them. You see, so I got like comics to narrate them and stuff. So, and then we sent a copy of the book to everyone who'd narrated a story. It's been amazing.
Oh, what a good idea. Of course, of course. The most important thing for any writer, you've got a waste paper bin. Here we are, 3rd of March 2021. Vital, if only metaphorical, vital.
I have two of them sitting beside me right now. Because I got a bigger one because the other one wasn't big enough.
I mean, it's the perfect metaphor for the writer's life. Get a really big bin. If you're going to be creative, get a big bin, guys.
Yeah.
I love that. We're in 2021 now, Quay, so the writing's up and running. Things are going brilliantly. You've got a Brandit Men's Savage Vintage Shorts. These are such a pair of dad shorts right here.
Oh, yeah.
They've got tassels hanging off them. They've got pockets on the side. There's zips everywhere. These are functional, but they're also very cool, but also the sort of thing you could imagine a prepper wearing.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
They are perfect for dog walks. That's what they are.
Yes.
And frankly, I am the guy now who has the big beard and wears shorts 11 months of the year.
Yes.
Because I don't need to leave the house most of the time.
You're a roadie.
I am exactly a roadie. I know I'm a roadie for my dog, basically. My dog's on tour. Because I just walk around. I've got big walking shoes and the dog, and me and the dog, we're opposite a massive, ridiculously big park, Lime Park, where It's where in Pride and Prejudice, what's his name, comes out with the lake.
Oh, yeah.
So we go out this big, walking around this thing with all this deer shit everywhere. So, that's the kind of stuff you need to wear when there's a lot of deer shit.
So it's not like a guitar being out of tune. It's him rolling in deer shit and the roadie runs on, deals with him, and then runs off again. This is it. You're a dog roadie and a writer.
I'm a dog roadie. Yeah,
this is great because when we write the description of this episode, which is nearly sadly coming to an end, by the way, I can put a list of things that you do. And of course, comedian, writer, writing for kids.
Dog roadie.
Yeah, but the headline one is going to be "And Dog Roadie."
Yes.
I love this. Creve, I could talk to you all day, but we're going to have to knock this on the head. But here's what we're going to do. There's loads and loads of stuff. And I should say fabulous, fabulous books that you've been buying over the last 20 years. But no book's more fabulous than your own. So if you haven't checked out Creve's writing, do. It's really good. It's funny. It's good crime stuff. And the sci-fi stuff is fabulous as well. What I always like to do, Creve, at the end is to try and sort of construe a meaning from the first and last things that you've bought, all right? And this is always a reach, okay? So the first thing you bought, of course, was Bill Hicks on audio CD. The serious student of comedy.
Edgy.
Getting on the road when times were tough, just after 9/11, when stand-up stopped and no one knew if they wanted to laugh anymore. And now here you are, and the latest thing you've bought is a light-up reindeer women's Christmas jumper. I mean, look for the meaning and it's there. You see it, don't you? You see it.
I mean, what's weird is we're recording this in July, but, you know, in my defence, they are a lot cheaper now. You see? I mean, I'm not the edgy, dark man I thought I possibly was in my early 20s. I think we can take away from that. I'm the kind of bloke who... What's worse is I'm buying that because my wife told me to buy it.
You're cozy, you're light up, there's light and love and warmth, and you're doing what the people who love you tell you to do. Do you know what I mean? We find the answers there.
I think I've genuinely found myself and I'm like going, I am a bloke who frankly prefers dogs to people. And isn't bothered about, doesn't want to go travel in the world to make people laugh. Likes the idea that people can just laugh at their own time by getting my books. That's wonderful.
You've gone from the stand-up racking up the miles to a sit-down comedian. There you are, parking yourself there. And you're a dog roadie as well. And it's a happy story. The arc is always towards justice. And I like that, Creve. It's been so lovely to see you again after all these years. And good luck with all this. And I really hope that it continues to go as well as possible. And obviously, crucially, I am available to play any middle-aged confused man. If there's a middle-aged confused man in any of the inevitable TV adaptations,
absolutely,
you know where I am.
My people will talk to your people.
Great.
By my people, I mean my dogs. That's they're my people.
I've got a black and white dog right here as well.
My dogs will ring your dog.
Yeah. Fine. They'll sniff each other's butts. Similar to what agents do. Oh, did he? Think he did. What? Dangerous. That's it. We're done. It's all over once again. Thank you to Creve. Next week, Catherine Ryan.
I'm going to put a falcon in my vagina. A realistic wind-powered bird of prey.
Just a little taster of what is to come. Go to patreon.com/toasterpod, and Catherine's episode will be going up at some stage today, Wednesday. So go to patreon.com/toasterpod. You can get your ears around that episode. I think it's £3 a month for basically everything. So do it. Do it. You know you want to. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for entering the competition. If you haven't entered this week, all you've got to do to win yourself a Shark vacuum cleaner, you could be in with a chance of winning it, is go to youtube.com/@mymatebourtatoaster. That is @mymatebourtatoaster. And subscribe. It's that simple. And one of the lucky subscribers will be winning a Shark vacuum cleaner next week. I love making this podcast. Sometimes I record this bit late on a Tuesday night before the show goes out on a Wednesday morning. And sometimes my kids are getting ready for bedtime and there's madness in the background. Would you like to hear a My Mate Bought a Toaster intro outtake? This was me attempting to record the beginning of today's episode a little bit earlier on. Listen carefully in the background. See if you can spot the moment where my youngest son has a massive argument with his elder brother. It's me and it's you, and we're reunited once more for another week of My Mate Bought a Toaster. Hello, thank you. Honestly, is it too much to ask for soundproofing and boarding school? There we are then. My Mate Bought a Toaster, done and dusted. Catherine Ryan next week. I'll probably see you then, I reckon. It's My Mate Bought a Toaster.